Hello, everyone. I'm Jim Paymar, and you are listening to The Big Shift, the podcast that looks at the seismic changes our world, our economies, and our institutions are confronting. Today, we're discussing a subject that's unfortunately in the news far too often, police brutality. Recently, we saw the brutal beatdown in Memphis, Tennessee of 29-year-old Tyree Nichols, a father of a 4-year-old, after he was stopped for a traffic violation just 100 yards from his home. The beating was severe. Nichols was brought to the hospital in critical condition and died 2 days later from his injuries. 5 police officers were indicted and charged with second-degree murder, aggravated assault, aggravated kidnapping, and other charges. Joining me to discuss police brutality and policing in general is Laura Goodman, a former sergeant in the Minneapolis Police Department and deputy chief of the Brooklyn Center Police Department, a suburb of Minneapolis. She now travels the world as a policing advocate, focusing on how to improve police-community relationships, reducing violence, and increasing the representation of women in police leadership roles. Laura, welcome to The Big Shift. Glad you could join me.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, Laura, I'd like to start with Tyree Nichols. In the videos we saw on TV, officers are seen dragging Nichols from his car, swearing and screaming at him. One officer pulls out a taser. Nichols runs and officers chase him. He says, "I'm just trying to go home." And officers are seen on the video repeatedly kicking and punching and using a baton as Nichols lies on the ground helpless. At one point, he's heard yelling, "Mom." When you saw this video, Laura, what went through your mind?
Enough is enough.
Yeah.
It's there's no police training whatsoever, none, that would have officers behave in that way. So I saw that as a culture in the police department that allowed for that kind of behavior to continue and worsen.
I mean, it was absolutely atrocious. I mean, after the first time you see it and they keep replaying it, it's just you just can't watch it. And the 5 officers charged in this murder were part of a special unit called Scorpion, and that's an acronym for Street Crimes Operations to Restore Peace. Now, there have been a number of police, kind of elite police units like Scorpion set up around the country in an effort to tamp down a spike in crime and make a statement to the community. Now, the police chief who set up Scorpion was a woman, Sarah Lynn Davis. She's an African-American. The 5 officers were African-American as well, as was the victim, Tyree Nichols. What does this say to you about police culture in general? Because usually we see white officers caught up in the beating of Black citizens.
What it says to me, it's what I talk of frequently, is that it isn't enough to make your police department look like the community it serves when you're just talking about men. What people refuse to talk about or are not talking about is women.
Mm-hmm.
And if we had women at the rates that they are in the community, 50%, but even if we had a critical mass of women in the police department, it would change some of this behavior.
Mm-hmm. But we had a woman who was in a leadership role who created this unit, who was backed by the mayor of Memphis, to kind of say to the community, "Hey, look, we've got some tough guys out there, and you better not monkey around." I mean, there's a problem there, isn't there?
Okay, so first of all, I'm not sure that that's why the unit was set up. So I think the issue is, and it continues to be, people don't want police violence until the crime comes to their neighborhood. And then they're willing to sort of look the other way because they want to feel safe. What
right.
I disagree with is the methods that people use to try to make people safe. The police department cannot function without the community. So what we need is to partner with the community, which is what real community policing is all about. It means we are working shoulder to shoulder with our communities to solve crime. If the community, for example, trusts the police department, then they will help. They will identify who's causing problems. They will help figure out ways to interject into that sort of violent behavior and try to change it. And right. I think that this police chief, that was more what she meant when she created this unit, not to create a gang of bullies who were out there beating up their own. And I don't know the extent to what they were doing, but what they did to Tyre was clear. This wasn't the first time.
Right. You know, with Laura, with crime rising in so many communities, people are now fearful of going out. They're afraid of gun violence in their neighborhoods. You know, political candidates released thousands of ads during the recent 2022 election focusing on violent crime. So that it kind of raises the paranoia level. And back in 2020, we heard many cities talking about defunding the police after the vicious murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, where you come from. All this makes people anxious. I mean, how do communities and police departments deal with a very, very tough job of keeping the peace while not hurting people or killing them in the process?
It's the only way they can restore the peace is by partnering with the community, by working with community leaders. They cannot, violence begets violence. It doesn't matter if you're the cops or a politician or a gangbanger. If that's your way to deal with it, then that's, you're just gonna get more of it. Mm-hmm. We have to start, first of all, we have a huge job in rebuilding trust in our communities. And the community is ready for that. They want to. Even in Minneapolis, it was like there was a small group of very liberal politicians who started that rant. I think they did it because they were scared about what happened with George Floyd. And they wanted to give the community something, but what they gave the community, they gave to a small, very small portion of the community. Even the Black community was not for defunding the police. They want partnerships with the police. They want to work with the police. They don't want to live in a crime-ridden neighborhood. Nobody does.
Right, right. And I've seen more than one television interview where, you know, Black people are afraid of the police. They're afraid that they're going to get stopped for a broken taillight and get thrown down on the street and handcuffed or brought in for some reason. And there's just this fear factor out there that we have to eliminate so that people do trust the police again.
Exactly. I mean, I don't blame Black people at all. I feel fearful of the police. I mean, when the red lights come on behind you, I mean, you just, in today's world, there's such distrust that you just don't know. And there, I don't know what kind of training is happening right now, but that when police have the sort of sense that they're right, they pulled you over, so they're right, and can't even accept say an argument or a defense of a person in the car, it's not the right way to be policing. Mm-hmm. We should be engaged. I remember a young police officer in the projects where we did have a lot of problems. I said something driving through the projects with a partner who I think was really one of the best police officers I ever knew. And I said something about this crime and these, like, these are all criminals. And it was largely Black. And that was my racism coming. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, the senior officer, he said, "Laura, if that were true, we couldn't be driving through this neighborhood right now."
Right.
He said, "It's not true. These are good people. They're trying to live their lives. They don't like living in crime any more than we do. And you need to change your thinking." Mm-hmm. And this is a white guy, a white senior police officer. And I thought, wow, I was so grateful to him for sharing that with me and for making me rethink how I was thinking.
Right, right. I mean, we all kind of need to reorient our thinking these days about how we live in communities with all sorts of people, you know, people of color and people with different religions, people who've come from different countries. You know, I read an analysis in the Washington Post, and it indicated that police in the U.S. shoot and kill more than 1,000 people every year. 1,100 people have been shot and killed by police from January of last year, 2022, to February 2023. Is there a way to change police tactics so we don't see this kind of carnage on our streets?
I think there is a way to change it. I mean, I think we need to, it's like over the years, especially since 9/11, we were on our way to real community policing when that happened. And once that happened, it was like pulling a rubber band out and suddenly snapping it back. Mm-hmm. And we went from being every police department having the goal of being a community service oriented police department, being partnered with the police. We went from white and powder blue squad cars back to black and white and getting military equipment and totally militarizing our police departments after 9/11.
Right.
Like everyone was the enemy now. And we forgot that we are not the military. We are police, a police service.
Protect and serve.
Exactly. Local police departments were never meant to be the military.
Mm-hmm.
They were meant to, if you went back to Peel, who was the father of policing, said, people are the police and police are the people. And the
right.
only difference is that the police people get paid full time for what they're doing, and the community serves as a responsible, productive member of the community.
Mm-hmm.
We have forgotten that along the way, that we cannot function as a police department without the support of our communities.
Yeah, now, you touched on this just briefly, and you've indicated that bringing more women into policing would help alleviate some of the brutality that we see occur in our cities. Why do you think that is so? And is there discrimination against women coming into police departments?
Okay, so yes, I think it's true that if we have a critical mass of women police department of every race, reflective of our communities, and women are half of our communities, that we would see a change in the culture. In fact, the only real strategy to change the culture of policing is to change the composition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's women.
Mm-hmm.
You can hire more men of every color, and it is not going to change because the men will assimilate into the culture that, by and large, white men have created.
Mm-hmm. It's a boys' club. It's been that way forever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how. I mean, I have my women colleagues when we were a handful on police departments, who, you know, we all tried to be like them. We all did.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, at some point, most of us thought, you know what, we're never getting in this club, so we're going to start doing policing the way we want to do policing.
Mm-hmm.
And not fall under their footsteps.
Yeah, and you mentioned to me on the phone the other day that there's a great deal of research about women and policing, and they tend not to use force. And when they do use force, they use what's necessary, not excessive force. That's not to say that women are afraid to use force, but they don't feel like they have to go overboard to make someone comply with their commands. I mean, we haven't seen women involved in the horrific attacks like Rodney King in Los Angeles or George Floyd in Minneapolis or Tyre Nichols in Memphis. Why the difference between men and women and the way that they police?
I think to begin with, that women come into policing with a different sort of philosophy. I mean, they go into policing because they want to help. They want to serve. They want to do something significant to change people's lives, which is really the most rewarding thing about policing, is the opportunity that you're given every single day on your job to change someone's life, to make a difference, hopefully in a good way. So secondly, women don't have, you know, women aren't socialized to get in a fist fight to solve problems, right?
Right.
They're not socialized, but men are. You panty waist, you fight like a girl, you know, like this is how boys grow up. So you take girls, first of all, they're socialized to be social, to take care of people, and to resolve conflicts by communicating, not by getting in a fist fight. As I said to you before, I was 5 to 115 pounds on the job. I'm not getting in a fist fight with people.
Mm-hmm.
I have to figure out other ways to solve problems, even if it's through trickery. I remember one time one of my female colleagues she's first on the scene at a bar brawl. And people are like, what are you going to do? And she's like, well, I'm going to either you guys can come in here and get my squad car and we can just go downtown like gentlemen, or I'll get on the radio and I'll have 10 cops here in like 5 seconds. And they just comply. So it's like there are ways to deal with things, and women are better at it.
Well, it's finesse, right? You can finesse your way out of a violent situation.
Mm-hmm. And it's not that you can always. I mean, believe me, I was in fights as a police officer. But generally, there were lots of us there. It was usually someone who was out of control because they were on drugs or alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't dealing with someone who had the capacity to think rationally about what was about to just happen to him or her.
Right.
So it's like you, and then the fight wasn't about getting in a fight for me. It was about getting the person under control.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I'm not throwing punches. Right? I'm not throwing punches. Even if I'm being punched, I'm not throwing punches.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to do takedowns to get somebody in handcuffs so I can get them in the car.
Right, right.
And that's the difference. I mean, why are police officers punching people?
Mm-hmm.
They are trained in most departments, I would suggest, we certainly were trained to do nonviolent intervention, to do takedowns, to... Mm-hmm. The way you put your hands on someone to render them, you know, not fighting, you know, and you can get handcuffs on.
Listen, you know, it's a tough job and every situation is different and the adrenaline is rushing and, you know, things happen out there. I think we all understand that. Now, you touched on this earlier. You're a big advocate of bringing more women into the police departments. And stats that I've read, more than, you know, as you said, more than half of our population in the U.S. is female, but only 12% of police officers are women. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, but only 3% of women are in leadership roles. So why so few women in police departments? And how do we create an environment where we can see more women as leaders?
Okay, so first of all, I just want to make this point. Women in policing has actually gone down since 2000 or been stagnant. So in 2000, we were about 14% nationwide with about 5% in leadership roles, which would be lieutenant and above.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're 12 and about 3. So part of the reason is that police departments continue to discriminate against women in the hiring process. And they also, in this discrimination, discriminate against smaller framed men. So mm-hmm. a lot of times the things that would help get women in police departments would also get smaller framed men into police departments, therefore benefiting both men and women. But one of the first things they do is they have pre-hire physical fitness tests that focus too much on upper body strength, which women have less of than men.
Right.
And so, and yet there's never been a study done yet that says having upper body strength or more brawn makes a better police officer.
Mm-hmm.
Never. I'm willing to see the study that's been out there that says that. Because better policing comes from being trained to do the difficult task that you might have to do, but to be better trained on the day-to-day activities that require conflict resolution skills, communication skills, problem-solving skills, resource-building skills, so you can help your community figure things out when they're in crisis. Those are the things that police officers need, but police departments continue to test most of the time pre-hire. Physical fitness that in some cases there's no way even to practice the skill.
Right. You've heard the name, I think, Maureen McGaugh. She's a chief of staff at the policing project here in New York at the New York University of Law. She heads up a project called the 30-30 Initiative.
Yes.
And the goal is to see 30% of new police recruits be women, and that they be brought into the police forces by 2030, which is not so far away. It's like 7 years ago away. Is that a realistic goal? Are there enough women who want to choose policing as a career path? Are there men still trying to block their path?
So yes, yes, and yes. So Maureen, so I have worked with Maureen from the beginning of 30 by 30. This all started from a group of women police officers that Maureen put together a summit or focus group to talk about what needed to be done. And out of that focus group came the idea of 30 by 30. 30 by 30's work also sort of comes off the National Center for Women in Policing's self-assessment guide for law enforcement that we wrote like 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And is still as valid today as it was back then. So what 30 by 30 is doing is a start. Mm-hmm. And what they're trying to do is get departments to sign on and keep track of data so that we can do more to facilitate getting more women in policing.
But is it realistic to go from 12% you said just a moment ago to 30% in just 7 years? I mean, are there enough women out there who want to police?
Well, so my dear friend Penny Harrington, who was the director of the National Center for Women in Policing and is now deceased, used to say, chiefs tell her all the time, we can't get women, they don't want the job. And she would say back, really? Like, which one of the women out there don't want a good paying job with a good pension that they can mm-hmm. retire after 20 years and go into an entirely different career and do whatever they want? I mean, who are those women who don't want those jobs, the stability for their families and children, some who are single parents? So yes, there's enough women out there. The problem is we discriminate against them. We don't make them feel accepted. We don't put anything in place that would invite them more in to learn the skills. And we scare them away by talking about policing as if it's the most dangerous job in the world.
Mm-hmm.
The reality, Jim, is it's more dangerous to be working in sales at 7-Eleven or yeah. FA than it is being a police officer.
Right. Yeah. There you see a hold up. But, you know, increasing the number of women in policing also, I think, would create an engagement with the community to build trust, you know, and you talked about establishing hiring criteria and better recruiting practices. Do you think if that happened, would it alleviate incidents like Tyree Nichols and George Floyd? What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, the thing is nothing is going to alleviate some stray cop from mm-hmm. doing bad stuff. But once it happens, there are things that you could put in place to, you know, early warning systems that would sort of pull, you know, identify those people earlier on and get them out. But I think that, can you imagine for a second, just close your eyes and imagine for a second, five women going up to Tyree, pulling him out of the car and beating him up.
I can't,
George Floyd, can you picture a woman kneeling on his neck while this whole crowd is saying, hey, he's not breathing, he needs help?
No.
Having a medical, I mean, women doing that?
Well,
I mean,
I have a hard time seeing that. And you know, you talk about police culture, and you said when you were on the force in Minneapolis, you know, when you were on the beat, that police often acted with absolute impunity. They did whatever they felt was necessary when coming in contact with a potential perpetrator, I should say. And that those who were confronted basically had no rights. Do you think that that's still the culture today?
I think it is with certain people. And I think the law, I think when the department doesn't hold people accountable, it just gets exponentially worse.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like anybody, take anybody. I mean, if you got away with stealing candy at the corner candy store and you got away with it, you would do it again.
Right.
And maybe this time you're gonna steal a bag of potato chips instead of this little penny candy or whatever. I feel like we're kind of hardwired to think, well, nobody said anything or did anything, so mm-hmm. it'll be okay. Mm-hmm. This must be the way it can work.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that when I was a young rookie and in my rookie class, I can't tell you how many times every one of us heard from our field training officers, I don't care what they said in school, this is how we do it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
how we do mm-hmm. it here.
Right, right, right.
And it's like, you're a rookie. You're on, which is why I feel bad for the two officers in the Chauvin that were just finishing their training, because this is your job.
Oh, yeah. Wait, you're talking about Derek Chauvin, who was the police officer with the knee on George Floyd's neck.
Right.
Yeah.
There were two rookie officers there. They were like 2 days beyond their, or something, a few days beyond their field training program, on probation.
They didn't really know the game.
And they had their field training officer, who was Derek Chauvin, mm-hmm. who was leading that group. And so it's like, you feel as a rookie, and this is part of the culture too, that you can't say anything.
Yeah.
You're going to lose your job. You're going to be blackballed.
Yeah. And so you better be a good, you better play along, or, you know, we'll deal with you. Yeah. And Laura, another issue, there seems to be so many aspects to policing, at least from what I've seen as a TV street reporter, New York, San Francisco, San Jose, Seattle. You have hardcore criminals out there. You have violent gangs, but you also have people on the streets who are mentally ill. You have domestic violence situations, you have the drug addicted, and you have the homeless. How are the police supposed to deal with this kind of complexity?
Well, I mean, it's a difficult thing, but one of the things that police can do is have resources available in the communities where they live, resources to help people who are on drugs or domestic violence or anything, really. Like, you, one of the best things a community police officer can do is, when they get on the job, is start hoofing the neighborhood and finding out, who are the people who can help my people in my area of patrol? Like, if you're in Minneapolis and your community is Somalia, what are the resources that help this group of people? And put those all together. But the other thing is that there needs to be more resources for those people. Like, so, for example, when I was a street patrol person years ago, there were still nights when detox was full.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we still had people so drunk they couldn't walk, or, you know, you couldn't just leave them out on the street.
Mm-hmm.
So then they'd have to go to the hospital. Well, nowadays, detox is full. The hospitals are full. What do you do with these people?
Yeah.
And that's a position that I think frustrates a lot of police officers, is there aren't enough resources to deal with the social troubles that are in that we live with. And police cannot handle them all. And having said that, that has nothing to do with why police are violent.
No, but perhaps having specialized units who can deal with certain circumstances, you know, they're expert, let's say, dealing with mentally ill or dealing with the drug addicted, and maybe having units that, you know, are just strictly dealing with violent crime. Is that possibly a solution?
You know, those units exist in the police department as sort of after the fact and get investigative. What are we going to do next?
Mm-hmm.
Like domestic violence units, weapons task force. I mean, all these units exist. The thing is that the cop who's on the street is dealing with it in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't, like, if you're a cop and you show up and maybe the call says it's a fight, and it's not a fight. It's a, you know, somebody who's having a party or somebody, mm-hmm. like people will call stuff in just because they want to get the cops there faster.
But, right.
You know, like no matter what the call comes out as, you don't know for sure what you're walking into. And then right. you're there.
Right.
Now you're there.
So the cop really has to adapt to a multitude of different situations and circumstances that arise. You know, when I was covering gang violence among the Crips and the Bloods for a program called The Reporters, we worked in some of the toughest areas, South Central LA and Compton. You know, I interviewed some social activists who claimed that the biggest gang in LA mm-hmm. were the police.
Yep.
And if the community doesn't trust the police and they feel that the police are a gang, how do you ever end the vicious cycle of crime out there?
Well, first of all, the entire LA Police Department was not a gang. But they
No, had, of course not.
They had these units, these specialized units that were behaving like gangs, stealing drugs from drug dealers, beating them up, taking their money. You know, whatever, but that is still not the majority of police officers.
No.
The majority of police officers go to work every day and put on a uniform and want to do good.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that it only takes about 1% of the police department to make it all bad or
right.
make it all look bad
or yeah.
feel bad for the community. So it's like we have to change the narrative on policing, number one. We have to stop, you know, with social media, for example, something like Tyre Nichols or
George Floyd.
George Floyd.
Yeah.
Or any police shooting. I mean, if a police officer is shot, for example.
Yeah.
You see it over and over and over and over and over again, yeah. into ad nauseum. And it's
yeah.
it begins to look like everybody is like that.
Yeah.
And it's not. And when do you see the reports of good police officers? When do you see reports of police officers who bring food to a family's home that they just had a call at because they see there's no food in the refrigerator?
No, yeah. I know. Believe me, I know. I worked on the streets for many years myself. And we're running out of time, Laura. And I do want to touch on one little thing here before we leave. Because you've done a lot of speaking overseas about women and policing, and you've indicated that there are many countries that are doing a much better job than we are in the States about bringing women into the police forces. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, I'll tell you what, Jim, not only that, but our own government, our national government, pays other countries to hire more police women.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody knows that it changes. I mean, it changes policing. Women police get more information. Community members trust them more. They're able to engage more. So when you have like Liberia, for example, Africa, you know, our country was paying to get women policing there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's just one example, but. And look at Kosovo, who's really only been a public police service since 1999. They already have 12% women in as colonels, 5% lieutenants, 8% majors. 8% captains, 8% lieutenants. Already, they've only been policing since 1999. Mm-hmm. And because they value women. They value what women bring. And it's been stunning to me to see how the respect that mm-hmm. the department, male and female, pay to each other. In Ecuador, has some of the highest ranking officers and well over 12% women. And they have an academy that's 4 years where they sort of live in the academy. Mm-hmm. If you're going to college, only you're in the police academy. And the relationships between the men and the women in the National Police there was just striking. Mm-hmm. It was like mm-hmm. they like each other. They mm-hmm. enjoy. But the other thing that what other departments have done is they've built cultural awareness into their training. Like in Ecuador, they even had to learn dance in the police academy. But dances of every one of the cultures that uh-huh. that lives in Ecuador. I mean, wow. How amazing is that?
Yeah. Laura, that is a subject for another interview with you down the road. But as usual, there's never enough time, but we'll have you back in the future on The Big Shift. And thanks for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Well, that was Laura Goodman, former officer with the Minneapolis Police Department and an advocate for women becoming police officers, not just in America, but around the world. I'm Jim Paymar, and you have been listening to The Big Shift, available wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening today, and stay tuned for the next episode of The Big Shift, coming soon. Stay tuned.